Hello, and welcome to the podcast for our first online discourse forum from the Path to Wisdom Project. The live Zoom broadcast was held on the 25th of June. The live forum is dynamic and vital, and not easily communicated in a recording, so I have decided to present a podcast with the material for those of you who wanted to attend but could not and requested a recording. This is the first session in an online discourse forum entitled Buddha Dharma or Buddhism, an introduction to the early teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. The presentation represents the views of the teachings of the presenter, and any ideas or thoughts expressed are strictly his, with no claim to absolutism nor conclusiveness. We encourage you to arrive at your own understanding in the spirit of our project, The Path to Wisdom. The Path to Wisdom Project believes that each and every one of us has the necessary material within us to engage in the search for truth and realization of our true nature, heart, and mind. The pursuit and realization of this leads to a more content, fulfilled, happier, healthier, and peaceful life. With this in mind, we are presenting this series on the teachings of the Buddha. In the future, we will be presenting other series as well, from other traditions pertaining to the same goal. In this series, we will discuss origins and teachings for which there are many existing versions. And as with all things, not all versions read or sound the same. Apply your own powers of contemplation and reflection to what you hear, and arrive at your own truth. My name is Padmapani, and I will be your presenter. I began my training at the age of 7 with my teacher, the late Venerable Subhadra Goldwater, and continued as his disciple until his passing at the age of 93. I received transmission in the Chan tradition, equivalent to ordination, at age 25 and began teaching formally at age 45. As in any philosophical discourse, it is important that we clarify and agree on vocabulary before we begin so that we can try to prevent misunderstandings from arising. We will do this throughout the discourse as is necessary. But to start with, I would like to address a few key words and what they mean. Please again keep in mind that these are translations, and because translators are human and culturally and socially influenced by their environments, as well as their traditions and their own thoughts, there may be variances when you come across these terms in other sources. So let's start with the first few terms. The first term is Buddha, which means the awakened one. There is nothing theistic or godly in the term. The second term is Bodhi, which means awakening, perfect knowledge, or is sometimes translated as wisdom. The third term is Buddha Dharma, which means the teaching of the Buddha or awakened one. The fourth term is Bodhicitta, which may be translated as awakening mind or mind of enlightenment. And the fifth term is Buddhism, which we will use as a general term for religions claiming to be founded on and expounding the teachings of the Buddha. First, let's make a brief review of the historicity of Shakyamuni Buddha. There are many books about the Buddha's life from many different perspectives. I am going to offer three very different titles. One of my teacher's favorites is the classic Gospel of Buddha by Paul Karras, written in 1894. Paul Karras was a key figure in the introduction of Buddhism to the West, sponsoring Buddhist translation work of D.T. Suzuki and fostering a lifelong working friendship with Buddhist master Soyin Shoku, and met with some controversy over his presentations. Another is The Buddha and His Dhamma by Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is an American Theravada Buddhist monk, ordained in Sri Lanka and currently teaching in the New York and New Jersey area. And a third offering is the well-known fictionalized account by Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha. Wonderful and easy to read, but truly a novel. However, this raises a very important point and question. Since so far nothing written down regarding the Buddha's teachings existed until about 400 years after his death, how can we claim any description is more accurate than another? We will discuss this later on in our discourse. Let us now review some of the key elements that we know as common to the currently known narratives. First, most of the narratives agree he was born into a royal family. And then early on, he was bothered by the problem of old age, sickness, and death, as common to all beings. He felt compelled to find a solution to the existential angst that these issues led to. He then decides to leave his family, parents, wife, and newborn son, and begins his search to find the truth and solution to this angst. In this process, he tries, practices, and excels at all the various spiritual practices of the day. Finally, he almost kills himself and is saved by receiving rice gruel from a shepherd girl. He then decides that the material way, that of wealth, possessions, and power, cannot solve his problem. And neither can the way of self-denial, the ascetic path. So there must be another path which leads to the solution. He then resolves to sit at the base of a tree and enter a deep form of concentration, dhyana in Sanskrit, chan in Chinese, or zen in Japanese, not meditation, which is a mistranslation, and not to arise until he has either figured it out or dies trying. Again, please keep in mind that all the information we have is second-hand recollection, as I mentioned previously. The Buddha did not write anything down. The topic of written or recorded material versus live dynamic discourse will be the subject for one of our future discourses. After his death, the first council was held, and it was said that even here there were some discrepancies between their followers. 100 years or so after his death, the second council was held, and again nothing was written, and again some discrepancies. Then 150 years or so after his death, the third council was held and sponsored by King Ashoka, who decided to send Buddhist practitioners as far as Athens, Alexandria, and Syria, where they settled and had communities. Perhaps this too is deserving of another future discourse. Finally, at the Fourth Council in the first century, it is commonly accepted that the first written material was actually put down onto paper or parchment. So how do we really know what really happened? Not an easy question. My teacher used to say that because we cannot ever be sure of what actually transpired, the best way we can understand the teachings is to pay attention to the various descriptions of how he lived and then try to figure out and see if they work. In fact, the Buddha himself often taught not to take anything at face value or just because he said it, but to take it and reflect on it and to practice it and to see what results would be obtained. Very much like the scientific method. So again, the big question arises, how do we know what we are experiencing? Is it real or just our desires or a fabrication of our minds? This also will be another topic for an upcoming discourse on Path to Wisdom, its origins and methodologies. My teacher used to often retell, as an example of the teachings, a story of the Buddha arriving at a royal palace. Once it was known to the king that the Buddha and his followers were nearby, the king sent a chariot to welcome the Buddha and bring him the final distance. Upon meeting the Buddha and requesting him to mount the chariot, The Buddha politely and respectfully declined, stating that his legs were strong and could carry him, as they did all the others with him. Another time, when the Buddha and his followers were staying in one of the groves during the rainy season, the royal requested that the Buddha come inside and stay in a room prepared for him. And again, he politely declined, saying that staying together with his followers was comfortable enough, and therefore more than sufficient. The implication is that the teaching was not only by words or ideas, but in actions as well. In this way, descriptions of the Buddha's behavior also become teachings. So now let's get to the beginning point of our first discourse. In this first session, we are going to present an overview of the first discourse of the Buddha after his awakening, and briefly touch upon the Four Noble Truths, as well as discuss some interesting perspectives offered for consideration. The Buddha almost dies and decides to try to find a middle path. After 49 days and nights, he experiences his awakening and basks in the peace it brings. But then he is moved by a deep compassion to share and try to teach what he has realized so that others can also end their suffering and find peace. In most presentations, this story and his teachings begin with the first discourse, often called the turning of the wheel. In this discourse, we learn about the Four Noble Truths and their fundamental role in the teachings of the Buddha. The first turning of the wheel, or first discourse of Shakyamuni Buddha, was to who would become his first disciples, and it elucidates the foundation instructions of the Buddha Dharma, the Four Noble Truths. Let us take a look at the truths and try to understand them in context. The first truth is the truth of dukkha, often translated as suffering. It refers to anything that is uneasy, uncomfortable, unpleasant, difficult, causing pain or sadness. The term dukkha does not have a one-word English translation and embodies diverse aspects of unpleasant human experience. It could be unhappiness, dissatisfaction, malcontent, lack of fulfillment, sadness, melancholia, or lack of inner peace. Fundamentally, it is based on the principle that we are always in a state of either wanting something we don't have, or wanting to avoid something we don't want to have, or wanting not to lose something we have, or wanting not to gain something we are going to gain. I would like to add to the usual states just mentioned an additional factor, an understanding that if we are aware of old age, sickness, and death as inevitable, and if we have not made our peace with it, then there will always be a seed of this fear within our consciousness, which will taint whatever it is that we do, feel, or think. The second noble truth is the origin of dukkha. The origin is tanha. Tanha can be described as thirst, or thirsting for, or longing for, or craving for, or desiring, eager for something, or eager greediness and suffering from thirst. Tanha is an important Buddhist concept and found in its early texts. It literally means thirst, longing, greed, either physical or mental. And tanha is one of the key factors leading to rebirth karma. The third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha. In the Dhammacakkappavattana, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma Sutta, it states, there is a noble truth about the cessation of suffering. It is the complete fading away and cessation of this craving, tanha, its abandonment and relinquishment, getting free from and being independent of it. That pretty much sums it up. And finally, the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Noble Path, which when practiced and realized will lead to the cessation of dukkha and many other things, which we will speak of in future discourses. The Eightfold Noble Path is right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. We will spend more time on each of these topics in future discourses, but let us now begin our discussion. We don't know if these were exactly the things that the Buddha said, and some study of the existent texts indicate that in fact these may be later compilations. Yet nonetheless, they were given the primary place when the written doctrines were compiled. So we can presume that they are fundamental. There is almost an infinite amount of literature and expositions and teachings on the above subjects from almost an infinite amount of perspectives, and no one can claim exclusivity because there are no direct links. As mentioned before, the oldest written documents are around the 1st century CE, which is 400 years after the Buddha's passing. However, based on practice and results, certain teachings have gained authority. Yet divergences among all the different schools still exist. For example, the path of mental practice and the path of devotion or faith, both having been said to be valid in obtaining the results of Nibbana or Nirvana, which for now we will call ultimate freedom. However, they differ in their styles, and it is said that the path of bhakti or faith eventually leads one onto the path of mental practice. The Buddhist schools founded by Shinran and Nichiren, both Buddhist monks, are the chanting schools which you may have read or heard about developed. The purpose of the chant is to bring a change in one's awareness. This technique was well established in both Vedic, pre-formalized Hinduism, and later in Hindu philosophy, many hundreds of years before the Buddha. And we can call it mantra practice for the purpose of discussion. However, today I would like to introduce a slightly different perspective than is commonly presented. Would this be right? Would this be wrong? It is neither. It is the perspective of a trained and certified practitioner in a lineage, so it has credentials. But it is only one perspective, as are all the other presentations which you may or will encounter in other Buddhist teachings. The right one for you is the one that works and begins to resolve the issue of dukkha on a personal level for you in your life. That is, it brings you closer to your true heart and a more fulfilled, content, happy, and peaceful life at all moments. Also, I would like to make it very clear that these presentations are just from my perspective and personal practice and study over the years. They are not offered to contend with any other spiritual perspectives or Dharma teachings, but as presentations for consideration, contemplation, and reflection, as an aid for one to arrive at one's own perspectives and awakening. Let's consider now, what was the Buddha's first real act that led to his awakening? Was it leaving his home? Was it practicing all the ascetic practices? Or was it sitting at the tree? What other possibilities may there be? Take a moment to reflect. In most presentations, the first act is described as his concentration practice under the Bodhi tree. My suggestion is that there was a prior act, and that was the decision to sit at the tree and either reach awakening or expire trying. So perhaps we could say the first act was setting his resolve not to turn back. Why is this important? I am proposing that without setting one's resolve to act on the process and allowing for no escape route, one will be buffeted by the currents of the process and not be able to break through obstacles that arise. Thus, resolve is very important. We will see later when we discuss more of the Four Noble Truths how this links very directly with the process. As this is the first in a series, we are mostly going to introduce topics, and in following sessions, we will enter into more thorough examinations. So let's accept resolve as the first step. Now let's continue with the first look at the four truths. Truth number one. Life is full of dukkha. I'd like to suggest an approach from the perspective of mortality. A Native American teacher of mine, the late grandfather Semu Huahate, a well-known Chumash elder, used to begin every gathering he spoke at with the following statement. The minute we are born, we begin to die. That's actually part of the contract we call life. This awareness starts at a subconscious level from a very young age. When suddenly we experience hunger or thirst or a desire for contact as a newborn, if it doesn't arrive soon enough for us, by our standards, we enter into a subtle state of panic because we do not yet know that in most cases it is not a life or death situation. A subtle subconscious existential fear establishes itself within our consciousness. Sometimes it is truly a life and death situation, and then the fear is definitely imprinted upon us. Let us, for our purposes, refer to this existential fear as dukkha in our present lives. But why do we continue to suffer this after we have received the nourishment as food or water or physical contact? Here we have the birth of the second truth, the origin of dukkha, or tanha, as we translated previously, craving or thirst. I would like to suggest yet another word for consideration, and it is adhesion, like being stuck to something, adhesive, such as glue. We adhere to the feeling of existential angst. Without being able to disengage, it becomes a part of our functioning at such a primal level that it eventually permeates almost everything we do. Again, we will discuss the process itself in more detail in a future discourse. Now we have need for a solution, the third noble truth, breaking the bond or adhesion to the fear or what it is that we are stuck to. Once we dissolve this adhesion, we become free to be present and respond to the present situation more freely and with more awareness. Of course, if we get stuck to something again, we return to the same problem. This is the process that the Buddha described as occurring for people that leads to their suffering. Adhesion, then perhaps letting go, and then adhesion again. This is the pattern which we need to break. And the Buddha provides a tool as we arrive at the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Noble Path, which consists of what we mentioned previously, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Usually when we read about the Eightfold Path, we are informed that it is not sequential but can happen in various sequences and at various times. I would like to suggest, not as an authority but as a point of view, that there is a sequence laid out, and this is the logic behind the path. Again, before beginning anything, we need to sense and feel that what it is that we are pursuing is real and correct. In the Dharmic sense, we would call that right view. Only after we view the reality and the world as it truly is, will we be motivated and moved to begin to walk the path and do the process. Or put another way, we will develop the second stage, or right resolve, to begin and stick with the process. Well, so, we could say that right view then leads to right resolve. Without right view, how will we make our resolve? And here I would like to quote a very well-known late Tibetan teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, with regards to resolve. And quote, "My advice to you is not to undertake the spiritual path. It is too difficult, too long, it is too demanding. I suggest you ask for your money back and go home. This is not a picnic. It is really going to ask everything of you. So it is best not to begin." However, if you do begin, it is best to finish. End quote. Resolve is very important. Without it, one may flounder and experience even more confusion in one's life. Once we have right view and right resolve, and we view things as they truly are, and we have resolved to commit to the process, we can begin to practice right speech. Now, when we read the word right, we can think in terms of something that has an ethical or moral value, but it is beyond the socio-cultural sense of ethics or morals, but a universal truth, which in the Dharma is said to be at the foundation of all manifestation. For simplicity's sake, let's call it a universal ethical moral quality. Returning to right speech, why speech? Well, let's give some thought to speech, which is a very complex and mentally all-inclusive and far-reaching action. In a very oversimplified description, for speech to occur, an intention must develop, then a thought must first form, and then a thought within a context, and then a concept of beginning, middle, and end of a phrase, either simple or complex, and then nerves, and then muscles, and finally coordination of all the physiology required for sound and speech. In this way, being mindful of speech requires great attention to our inner processes, which we can accomplish independently without any outside engagement. Speech is therefore a great place to begin for paying attention and being mindful. Once we undertake to attempt and hopefully progress with right speech, we progress to the next stage, which would be right action. And again, by right, we are understanding a universal and moral ethical action. Perhaps we might even define it as action that benefits all beings. For many people hearing this benefits all beings, or reading this, the idea that action that benefits all beings can even be possible causes a reaction arising that it's not possible. But if we further examine in more detail, which we will do in future discourses, we may find that this may not necessarily be so, and perhaps there are actions which can benefit all beings. From right action, we progress to right livelihood, or living one's life without directly or intentionally harming others. Here is another quote which my teacher liked to express often. Quote, Buddhism sees daily work as a means for the purification of human character. Only through healthily employed individuals able to find integrity, concentration, and equanimity in their daily work life does the optimum situation for the development of a strong and compassionate society exist. End quote. And so, first we have our right view, we then have our right resolve, we move to our right speech, and from there to our right action, and then to our right livelihood. Having established our place in life and the world, or trying to live according to a universal ethical moral manner in speech, action, and livelihood, we move on and consolidate everything and all of our actions into right effort in all the activities which we undertake. We have now hopefully developed a deep arising of commitment to a method of living which nourishes us and starts to have an effect on our well-being in a positive way. And from here we move and integrate right mindfulness, which is not the same thing as the mindfulness we hear, read, and see all over the airwaves and internet these days. Why? Again, right mindfulness is applying right as a universal ethical moral code with mindfulness, an essential characteristic, and it becomes mindfulness which entails the involvement of a universal ethical and moral quality and imbues the practice with it both as a quality and a result, not just a practice for improved health, increased efficiency, or stress reduction, as is so often the way mindfulness is marketed today. And in completion of the path, we arrive at the eighth stage, which is right concentration, which is the very act of penetrating the very deepest realms and principles of reality itself. This is something which is very difficult to describe in words, as the process is beyond language and thought as we commonly use them. So for now, in this basic introduction, we're going to leave it there. But in future discourses, we will go more deeply into right concentration. We've summed up everything, we've concluded it, and I think we can rest here as our first discourse, as it's quite a bit of material. In summation, Prince Siddhartha Gautama, wanting to find a solution to old age, sickness, and death, left his royal life after concluding that all the material wealth and possessions would not provide a solution. Then for many years he practiced many, if not all, of the ascetic practices, promising to offer a solution, but none came, and only death approached from deprivation. Then he resolved, to sit and go into deep concentration until he either passed away or penetrated reality and found the solution. After 49 days, he awoke and became the Awakened One, or the Buddha. Compassion, which is one of the universal ethical morals, which naturally arises with deeper penetration of reality, encouraged him to offer what he experienced to others, but always with the caveat that this is what I did, what I experienced. I offer it to you for your own use as a method which is tried and tested and works. However, if you find it not for you, then let it be. He then gave the discourse called The Turning of the Wheel, and it consisted primarily of the Four Noble Truths: dukkha, its origin, its cessation, and the method for facilitating its cessation, the Eightfold Noble Path. Here, we are going to end the podcast for our first discourse. We hope you found it interesting, and we welcome you to join us for our next online live forum discourse, the details of which will be announced by email if you have registered on our website. The live dynamic is always much more active and even fun, as we have the opportunity to discuss among the participants many of the concepts. Until then, take care, be well, and wherever you are, be at peace.